Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello to everybody listening here. This is Ashton Furie speaking. I am hosting this series on risk. The reason we're talking about risk is because many people have a negative connotation when it comes to risk. And yet what we want to do is we want to reframe risk and hopefully equip our listeners to ask better questions about risk. Also specifically to put risk in the context of Africa and how risk might look different and how you might want to think differently about risk in the African context. I am the founder of 5 to 50, which is a business focused on helping small businesses of at least five people that have been running for at least 5 years to grow to 50 people and to free the founder from the day-to-day grind of the business so that people who are good at founding and starting and growing new businesses are able to do more of that. I'm also group COO for KVR Equity, which is a human capital solutions business with our core focus on training and human development, especially in the space of Black economic empowerment and ensuring that all the necessary requirements are met to ensure that people get all their points that they can get for that, but at the same time, make sure that we really have a positive impact. And with me today, I have Andrew Janssen, who is a director at Aristic Asset Management. He'll tell you a little bit more about who they are and where they come from. He's MD at Lexus Securities. And he was born and bred in Namibia. He spent the last 30 years working in all the facets of the investment space, from financial analyst, portfolio management, securities, private equity. And this, of course, has involved a lot of risk management. Andrew, if you could maybe introduce yourself and do a brief overview, just where you've come from, the businesses that you have run and built, and where you are today, and then we'll take it away from there.
Excellent. No, thank you very much, Aston. And thank you indeed for the invitation to be speaking on this podcast. As you mentioned, I was born in Namibia, born in Windhoek, grew up in Windhoek, lived in Windhoek for 50 years, went to school, studied at the University of Namibia, did a lot of my further studies, my postgraduate studies via distance learning. But my foundation literally started in studying accounting and auditing. And I spent 5 years as a financial manager of the largest pension fund in Namibia, the government's institution pension fund. It's called the GIPF for short. Very early in my career, I obtained the CFA designation. It's called the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. This is a global qualification specializing in investments. It's a self-study program. It covers three exams. In the old days, you could write it only once a year, so you had to do it over 3 years. And I qualified already in 2001. That's more or less the same time when one of my biggest opportunities in life came along, when JP Morgan Chase closed their offices in most of the African countries except South Africa. And in Namibia, they also had an operation, JP Morgan Chase Namibia, and we had the opportunity to buy the business from them. And that's certainly where my entrepreneurial journey started. We renamed the Namibian JP Morgan Chase business Simony Storm Securities, and I went about taking over two more stockbroking operations in Namibia, that of HSBC Namibia and also Lexus Securities. After that, I spent about 13 years focusing on running Simony Storm, after which I took a bit of a sabbatical and I enrolled myself for an MBA at the University of Cape Town, the Graduate School of Business. And through my MBA studies, I think it was the Holy Spirit that tugged on me to say, maybe you should start an asset management business to have a greater impact on Namibian society. And I literally started the business from scratch, 2016. And so Aristic Asset Management was launched. Our focus is primarily managing investments in so many storm for high net worth individuals, looking at the various, let's call it wealth offerings or wealth solutions, which includes long-term, short-term insurance, estates, trusts, and wills. And under Heuristic Asset Management, we do investments for the institutions, the pension funds, and life insurance companies in Namibia.
Wow, Andrew, that is really quite an amazing journey. I think a lot of your experience and your training was about how to identify risk and how to maybe in many cases avoid risk or maybe mitigate risk. But one of the most risky things that we can do is to say, let me leave this world of large name investment and actually run something for ourselves, buy this business and bet on that we can actually make this happen.
Yes, I am trained as an auditor. So I'm trained in risk, how to look out for risk, how to identify it, and how to mitigate against it. But also, I can see what the rewards are, what is the payoff. It also helped me be prepared because it gave me a foundation and also experience in different and very, very diverse industries. But at the same time, it also helped me develop a wide network. For instance, the companies that I audited, it ranged from, you know, from investment trusts to life insurance companies to banks to mining operations, medical aid funds, pension funds, certainly was also amongst my clients. So I believe that that was also a bit of luck on my part, the luck to choose the right industry to receive my training in, and also then the luck of building up such a wonderful and wide network. Somebody once defined luck as follows. He said, luck is where preparation and opportunity meets.
I really like that little phrase that you said there of luck is the place where opportunity and preparation meet. And what's very interesting for me is I listen to a lot of podcasts, I listen to a lot of leaders, and it's amazing how many of the sort of what Jim Collins in his Good to Great book would call the level 5 leaders are very humble people. And very often when you talk to them about their successes, they would go, well, we were just lucky because we had the right team. We were just lucky because we had the right processes in place at the time when something went wrong, or we were just lucky because this opportunity came along. And I think even in your scenario, you mentioned this opportunity to buy the business and you were sort of lucky to be able to buy this business. But on the other hand, you had the preparation, you had done the studies, you understood the market, you had worked there and built a network that enabled you to make that transaction happen. But what are some of the biggest risks that you've taken? And then how did you manage the tension in your marriage of taking entrepreneurial risk?
Yeah, no, it's that's a very, I'm smiling and I'm actually getting a few tingles at the back of my spine because it's nice in hindsight to sit now and say, thank you, God, that it worked out. But, you know, at the time it wasn't pleasant, you know, so I'll tell you about the biggest risk that I've taken was probably to invest in the stockbroking and wealth management business of JP Morgan when we bought it in 2001 and we rebranded it to Simony Storm. So one, I was working for the Government Institutions Pension Fund as a financial manager, was earning a nice salary, just recently moved into a newly built house. Coincidentally, my wife's dad, her father, built the house for us. So she had the dream kitchen. She had, you know, nice cars and the two boys were still very young. Nick was about 6 and Chris was practically a baby. He just turned 1. And I had to tell Zurita, my wife, I had to now convince her that we need to sell our newly built house and invest in this business because we needed capital in the business. Together with that, I also had to to take a salary cut. I was earning a nice salary, but the new business obviously could not afford the, you know, all the benefits and so on. So one of the reasons why I agreed to be part of the purchase of this business was there was about 5 or 6 people that would have immediately lost their jobs. There was clients that was built up, not a big client pool that was built up. And those clients, we would have basically left to find their own ways. You know, somebody else would have taken over. They probably had to liquidate some of the investments and they had to go and look for other service providers. So I said to myself, here I am. I think I have been prepared, you know, because I had the qualifications, the experience, and I hope that I had the heart for people to make sure that I could salvage this situation. And it was certainly not easy. You know, when I dropped the kids off at kindergarten and at school at about 7 o'clock in the morning, I'd go straight to the office and my workday basically started at 7:15. And most evenings I would work, earliest I'd come home would probably be 7 o'clock, sometimes later. For the first 2 years, I nonstop worked, you know, a minimum of 12 hours a day. Yeah, thank God it worked out. 3 years later, I was able to buy not the same house, but a very similar house. And we thank God for that blessing. I was able to make amends on, and also to keep to my promise. I said to my wife at the time that there is a reason why we must do this. We don't know it yet. We don't understand, but I think this is an opportunity for us to make a difference. So I'm guided by what the Holy Spirit, you know, is trying to say to me, trying to be obedient and to listen. But also I'm guided by the wisdom, you know, godly wisdom that is all captured in the Bible. I think all business principles are there. We must just read and let the Holy Spirit talk to us.
Could you maybe tell one or two stories of certain lessons maybe that you learned that prepared you for moving from this, like I'm employed, to actually running my own company?
I think when working with high net worth individuals and, you know, looking after investments, there's a lot of trust that your clients place in you. Trust is a very subtle thing. It's both the expectation that you as the expert, the person handling their finances, you know best. It's also the expectation that you will also look after it the best you possibly can. And there's, for me, one of the early lessons that I learned as a young auditor was where people fell to the temptation of, you know, taking things that did not belong to them. So imagine having a young teller, having access to the bank's vault. You have access to hundreds of thousands of Namibian dollars or rands in those days. As a teller, you're handling these big amounts of cash. There's certainly a temptation. I think most people would not fall into temptation if it was not the access to that opportunity. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, fall prey to that trap, the trap of greed, if their foundations are not set right, if they do not have a firm belief in God, in Jesus, that He will provide, that you don't have to do anything special. You don't have to, you know, pull out the rabbit out of that. If you don't have money to buy lunch or dinner, He will provide. You can believe in it. So unfortunately, I've seen a lot of people, not a lot, but a few people being arrested at work, being handcuffed and walked out of the offices in shame and being accused of theft and fraud, you know. So that lesson I took very, you know, very seriously is that once you are entrusted the assets, the belongings of the person that entrusted to you, that is not yours. You are only a custodian. You're only a fiduciary. You can control it. You can apply it, but the rewards and the risks that is attached to that goes towards the owner and they pay you for the service that you provide. Another example, that I learned, very early, also was the principle of how you leave one place is how you enter the next one. So when I left the employment of the GIPF, the Government Institutions Pension Fund, where I was the financial manager for 5.5 years, two things happened because of how I did my work, how I conducted myself, and how I managed my relationship with my seniors and also the leadership of the fund at the time. So when I left, they appointed me to the board of directors of one of the local banks in Namibia, where they were a majority shareholder. And later, they also appointed me to manage a SPV. It's called a special purpose vehicle that was established via a merger of this particular bank and another local bank. And the beauty about that was when we wound up the transaction, very soon after that, we actually wound up the SPV, I managed to negotiate additional shareholding for the GIPF in this local bank. So yeah, the way that you leave one place, that's certainly a way that you will enter the next place. And that also goes to churches, work, schools. The way that you leave is the way that you enter.
I really like that concept of the way that you leave is the way that you enter. I think so often we think, oh, finally, that's over. Now there's like something new in front of me, and you get there and you get to the other side and you go, actually, look, it's still me. The same me is still here. Like you drag your own strengths and weaknesses along. But one of the things we've now spoken about until now is risk. And you've defined quite nicely luck, which is almost like the other side of risk in a way, like the risk for things to go well. But risk is really about the things that can possibly go badly. How would you define risk?
Risk is one of those abstract concepts, but I'll try my best and to define it. So for me, risk is the potential for permanent loss. So when I mean permanent loss is the loss of life, the loss of money, the loss of the ability to generate income, the loss of your reputation. And most of us want to avoid all of the above. So for me, that's kind of my simple way of defining risk, the potential for loss.
So that idea of loss, I think most human beings, it's interesting, the research around that, how we feel worse about having lost something than not gaining something. And I think that's where entrepreneurs are in that difficult scenario of constantly having to say, what's the risk versus what's the reward, and balancing that and putting it. And you mentioned the word permanent. I always like seeing risk on a sliding scale, where on the one side is obviously like the potential of massive gain, and on the other side is the potential of massive or permanent loss. And everything that can possibly go right or wrong is somewhere on that continuum. And I find that often it helps me to think through opportunities in that way, in terms of what's the size of the potential loss or the potential gain, but then also what's the likelihood. So if you can maybe talk a little bit about mitigating risk, how have you in the past approached this idea of, okay, I see the risk, but I want to take the opportunity. So how am I going to manage and mitigate this risk?
So for me, a key principle around risk management and mitigating risk is actually found in Proverbs 21 verse 5. It reads, "The plans of the diligent lead to plenty, as surely as haste leads to poverty." And I have learned over many, many years, this is now certainly almost three decades, that there is tremendous power in planning. So not ideas, not thoughts, it's things that you put down on paper and that you put action to it. Along the years, I've learned that in business, there are about four important principles. I call them, that's our four P's. Well, not really four P's, but there's certainly a few P's in there. So processes, people, systems, and philosophy. those are the, I think, the four key foundational items in any business. So when we sit down and we plan, in earlier years, we had to look at what systems we needed, what systems we already have, what systems we need, and what systems we need to implement. We also had to develop business processes. We also had to sit down and document what is the steps from generating an investment idea, how we actually research those ideas, how do we come to a conclusion as to what action needs to be taken, and then also then the action that is taken, what actions needs to be taken, and then obviously evaluating the results of those actions. Then in terms of people, you know, without any staff, without people, you can't achieve a lot. I know that there is artificial intelligence, but you still need, even with AI, you need a human eye over what has been generated by the technology. And for me, AI is certainly a tool. It's not a replacement for people in our businesses. And then philosophy, you obviously don't change your philosophy, your investment philosophy or investment style over time, but you certainly need to evaluate it periodically and make sure that everybody around the team still believes in the philosophy, that they still buy in. And through evaluating all these four aspects of business, you certainly take into account things like the current business environment, what is the latest trends, what is happening in the market, what is happening in recruitment, what is happening in remuneration, what is happening with competitors, what is happening with the regulatory environment, etc. So all of that impacts in some or other way in one of these four principles that I've mentioned.
I really like the way that systematically works through the key areas that'll impact on the future of the business, and to really identify what are the important things that we're going to do in this next year that are often never urgent. Often, I think the urgent things are often the things that feel like those are the ones that present the big risks. If I don't get this done today, then this is going to go wrong or that's going to go wrong. But I think a risk we often don't see is the risk of not taking the time to really think about what are we doing in the next year. That's really important, getting that done. So that I really identify with. How do you relate to clients who are naturally more risk adverse?
You know, managing high net worth individuals, it's a tough one. But I think, you know, in saying that it's difficult, most human beings are driven by emotion. That is just human nature. We all are fearful. We all get scared. Some of us gets easily influenced. Some of us gets easily swayed by what we hear, what we see. Regardless of whether it's, you know, in investments or life, health, or even in relationships. So what we've done with our high net worth clients, we sit down with each and every client. These high net worth individuals are typically clients that own share portfolios, which are on the higher spectrum of risk. You know, the market can, in a specific country, region, or an asset class can vary in value, well, in price, not value, price, you know, dramatically on a given day. To give you an example, a few days ago, there was some announcement, earnings update from a company that is well known in the retail space, and the share price dropped by 10%, you know, on one day. But the shops, the stores that they have, those stores are still there. Those stores are still having inventory. Those stores are still selling. So not a lot has changed, but it's just the market perception. And that's the element of human nature being swayed. So we sit down and we develop a well-crafted investment plan for our clients. They understand. We document their investment objectives, which includes and addresses all these risks, you know, risks, the returns that are expected, time horizon, liquidity needs, etc. And we spend a lot of time talking to clients and explaining to them, firstly, what is happening in the market, why we are invested in certain investments on their behalf, and then what they can expect from those investments. Our interests and our clients' interests are certainly aligned. So we make sure that we understand what we invested in, and we make sure that it's appropriate for our clients. And we also invest in a similar way for ourselves, for our business, for our family, for our friends. You know, the way that I treat $100 from a client versus the $100 from my son or my wife, I look after the many billions that we are entrusted with, you know, as if it's, you know, my next of kin, you know. So for me, there are two things in life, or at least my life as an investment manager. So most people would say there are no free lunches in life, but I believe that diversifying, having diversification in your portfolio, and the concept of mean reversion, that those would pretty much come close to free lunches, because we've seen over time that investments tend to revert to their means, you know. So historically, if a company traded at a specific multiple over time and it's trading below that multiple, we would typically want to invest depending on certain evaluations. And if it's above that, we would certainly certainly consider that to be too expensive. So the risk of losing everything in a diversified portfolio is diminished to virtually zero. That and being accountable to God for any actions. You know, I believe that, you know, managing and looking after people's assets is a calling. And through my work, I try to do the best that I can, and also to honor God for that, you know, through my work. In other words, I do my work as a testimony of my faith and also a sacrifice to God, you know.
What you said about mean reversal actually triggered an interesting question for me from the perspective of, you know, some of the people that are listening to this podcast are part of the larger faith-driven entrepreneur and investor network. And many of them, I think, are looking at us and saying, well, how is it different in Africa? I maybe want to invest in Africa, but is the risk bigger or smaller there? I know Zach Zikar, I think is his name, is the one of the leaders of the Solving the World's Greatest Problems. He's a ex-Wall Street trader who specifically specialized in finding discrepancy between value and price. And when he finds that discrepancy, he identifies if the value is significantly higher than the price, then that is something that they would invest in. So when you were talking about mean reversal and saying, well, if a business has been trading at a certain rate and then now it's trading below, then I liked your retail example, drops by 10%, but it's got exactly the same stock, exactly the same shares, exactly the same shops, stock, people, systems, processes, all your P's have not changed between yesterday and today, but the price has dropped by 10%. So there's a good chance that that price will recover again. But he makes a comment that he believes that in Africa, there is actually a significant difference between value and price at the moment, and that a lot of businesses and stocks in Africa are underpriced because of the perception of the high risk in Africa. I'd love to know your thoughts on that, because a lot of what you just explained is very typical of, I can imagine if I was speaking to a stockbroker in Wall Street, he would be giving me many of the same kind of principles and that you give me. But is it different to invest in Africa? Are there opportunities? Is the risk significantly higher in the markets that you work than if you were operating in the US market, for example?
No, Ashton, no, that's a very good question. And we face that continuously. We obviously also travel to the UK on a regular basis, to the US, and we speak to people from all walks of life. And it's unfortunate that people don't understand and know Africa properly. I think there's still a belief in parts of the world that Africa is one country. That, yeah, it's, you laugh at that, but it's true. People believe that Kenya is very close to South Africa or Namibia, but people don't understand it's a 5-hour flight to get from Johannesburg to Nairobi, for instance. But in answering your question, you know, and I'll try to articulate it. I think even as an African, investing in Africa has got a number of challenges. So there's a number of things that I can mention, and all of that poses a level of risk. So if I give you an example, so there are parts of Africa that are French, parts of Africa that are Portuguese, parts of Africa that are in English. You're looking at vastly different cultures. You're looking at legal systems that may differ, because the Anglo countries are typically, you know, with the British legal system. You're looking at different currencies. You're looking at, I mean, in Europe, you've got the concept of the Schengen visa. So the countries that are signed into or have agreed to the Schengen concept, you can travel freely between France, Germany, Italy, Spain. In Africa, you still need a passport to travel. For instance, we as former South Africans, we need a passport to come to Johannesburg or to Cape Town, you know. So you've got all those nuances. And then you've got a level of development that also differ. You've got population sizes that differ vastly. You've got very specific dynamics that are driven in a specific region. You know, the difficulties that, let's call it, the Northern African countries are facing are not, you know, very similar to the challenges that we face in the South. The African countries, mid-Africa. So to say that it's more risky to invest in Africa as a blanket statement may not be entirely correct, but there may be nuances. And for me, as a Namibian, I'm quite comfortable to invest in Namibia and South Africa, because I understand the environment, I understand the people, the businesses, the business environment. If you can go to a country and you've signed a contract and you can enforce that contract, that is the basis of doing business. So I think a lot of African countries, you may have challenges with a different emphasis on some of these concepts, and also the level of, let's call it, the challenge, you know.
Let's take it one step further and say, so let's say I was a high net worth American family, for example, and we maybe have now listened to some of these podcasts, and we're thinking God is guiding us to invest in Africa. What would be your advice to such an investor who maybe at this moment knows nothing about anything in Africa, maybe a 3 or 4 steps of what you would say, these are the things you should think about and these are the things that you should do?
I recently attended Forge, for instance, and I was not aware that there is a movement of believers, people that are trying to do the best they can with the resources that they've got in making a difference in the world. And certainly in Africa, we've got a lot of need. So as a first step, I would advise people to team up with people like, for instance, Zawani and others. There are organizations that already have experience and a presence, and also the expertise, and also projects potentially that they could invest in. So my advice would certainly be not to try and do it on your own, to partner with people that already have got some experience and that have demonstrated the ability to actually operate in that space.
I think that's very good advice. I think relationship is one of the most powerful antidotes to risk. And if you connect with someone that you can build a strong relationship with, and you know that they have relationships with people that they trust, then you can systematically build that network of trust and and possibly reduce the uncertainty and reduce the risk. I really like that. What are some of the risks that are specific to your environment in Namibia that might be different to other countries in Africa and to different international markets? Are there specific things that you would say to somebody if they said, well, let me come and maybe put some money in Namibia, that they should be considering, which they might not be thinking of if they're coming in from other markets?
So this is now my chance to tell people about our beautiful country. We are a peaceful, loving, welcoming people in this country. So the country is about 2.5 times the size of Germany, and there's only 3 million people. So, for the listeners out there, you should come and visit us. Our economy is certainly still developing. It's in a developing mode. And there are a lot of opportunities for investors. There are a lot of needs, and investors are welcome. We, our legal system, our banking system, our audit fraternity, all of that is very strong. So what is nice about Namibia is we've got absolutely no capital gains tax. We've got no donations tax, and also there's no inheritance taxes in Namibia. So it's certainly something to consider, you know, for anybody to do something in Namibia.
Well, those are three very compelling reasons to consider moving to Namibia next week. Andrew, this has been an amazing conversation. I think many people do simply believe that every country in Africa has a broken legal system, broken financial systems, auditing doesn't work, everything's corrupt. And maybe I'm exaggerating a bit, but it's great to hear that in Namibia, and similarly in South Africa, we have systems and institutions that actually work the way that they are supposed to work. Andrew, it's been a very good conversation. Thank you very much. Do you have any last comments before we say goodbye to the listeners?
I just want to say thank you to you, Ashton, and for giving me this opportunity and to invite me onto the podcast. One thing that I can mention that I have literally for 30 years, I've only looked at the return part. So we talked about the two coins of investments, the risk part and the return part. And I have, I don't want to say inspired, but I think I've been moved to start something in Namibia that is not only investment returns focused, because there are elements that sometimes you can take a lesser return and there's a, let's say, a societal impact. And that could be, you know, addressing poverty, education, unemployment, it could be health challenges. And those challenges we certainly have in most African countries, and certainly it's present in Namibia. But I think the one thing that is missing, and the concept of investment, impact investments have been around for a while now, but impact investment was mostly on the ESG side, the environmental, societal, and governance aspects. And I said to myself, I want to do something that has got kingdom impact. And I am now busy, and I'm in an advanced stage of finalizing my investment policy. I've shared it with a few people. To establish a fund, a kingdom impact-based fund. How can I help finance investment needs of kingdom-driven businesses and, believing entrepreneurs that have a need for capital? But together with that, I want to also give an element, because I think the mentoring part is also missing, you know. So a lot of people, you know, you start a business and, there's no separation between the business account and the personal account, for instance, like basic governance things that I think I can add value to. So I'm hoping to launch the fund in the next, before the end of March. That's my target date. So I've also committed to seed the fund with some of our family investments. So I'm hoping that I can convince people in Namibia, maybe some of our clients, friends, family, to co-invest in this fund to make an impact, for the kingdom.
Andrew, that sounds really exciting, and I wish you all the best with that. I really hope that and pray that that will actually take off, that it will be successful, that it will accomplish the goals that you have set for yourself on that. And with that, thank you, everybody, for listening. Andrew, thank you very much for the amazing insights that you shared with us, and looking forward to the next episode.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partnered together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.